The following Noble Path talk is part of an informal series offered to Sangha members for those who've been practicing at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Each Sangha member shares their experience of how they came to find the Dharma and how their practice has been developing. We hope you enjoy the diversity of voices and experiences. Thank you for listening.
Happening there. That's kind of our biggest session of the year. It's a commemoration of the Buddha's enlightenment. And she and I think a few other regular temple practitioners are there right now. So a Noble Path talk is, I'm not a teacher. It's really, Hojin Sensei introduced this, and I think some of you have given this talk. It's a fellow practitioner who's currently on the path to clarification, and it's a sharing with the Sangha of their journey. How did I get here? How did I wind up here? What was the path that led me to here? And how's it going? So that's what I'm going to share with you. Hopefully, I'm going to kind of share my life a bit. Hopefully, some of it you'll resonate with, and that it's universal. Then there will be some that's very peculiar to my karma, and you may not quite connect with it. But I hope this is of benefit to you. I have these glasses that I have to do that with. No, this is fine. So I find this is a good question that Hojin asked me to take up. How did I get here? I think it's a good question for each of us who've been practicing a little bit to ask ourselves. I found as I reflected, recapitulated my life, that my awareness of what I thought were great struggles in my past or bad events, kind of my perspective kind of shifted. Like it just unfolded the way it was, and there's kind of nothing wrong with any of it. Shugen Roshi has recently, I remember in a talk, he questioned us, when did you begin your path? And he suggested that perhaps it started before you recognize it started. It may have been originated before an event that you think participated starting this journey. And now we're all at different places. Maybe this is your first time here. Maybe this is your first time ever meditating or even doing anything spiritual. But there were questions that brought you here. Where did those questions come from? When did those questions start? You know, you could be doing other things. So we're all on the path one way or another. So this question of, when did I begin this path? When did you begin this path? What precipitated entering this path? And once having entered it, what? Because the path isn't just a straight line. It's twisty. It's curvy. We're all going in these strange directions that we can't predict. So there are times where our questions that may have been very strong are kind of a little bit more in the background, and we kind of fade a little bit away from practice. What precipitated that fading away? And then what was the cause of us returning to practice? It's good questions to contemplate. So here goes my life. I was born in Southwest Michigan in a rural town to very young parents. My parents were sort of the black sheep of their family. My extended family, grandparents were very ultra religious. And reflecting on this, I think there was a lot of trauma going back generations, alcoholism, violence, and I think having a very strong, conservative, religious, hardline view is a coping mechanism to that. But I think looking back, I appreciate, and my parents were anti-religious. They didn't want to have anything to do with it because it was repressive, and they sought out their happiness through parties and alcohol. So I had a little bit of a distance to look at both of those paths and say, that's not it. And it kind of gave me the space to have the freedom to chart my own path. I think about all of my cousins and how they didn't have that space that I had. So the earliest memory I can think of where I started questioning reality, what is really true, what's going on here, was when I was 12. My best friend was the same age, and I asked him, what do you think about becoming a teenager? And he said, I'm so excited. I can't wait till I turn 16. I get to drive. I can't wait till I turn 18 and I can do what I want. I can't wait till I turn 21 and I can drink. And I remember being taken back by the answer because it was opposite of the way I felt. I was like grieving the loss of my pre-adolescence, the carefreeness of childhood, and kind of having a sense that that was gone forever, never to return. And I felt alone in that because nobody else seemed to share what I was feeling. So I kind of felt a bit isolated. Let's see. My school years were miserable. I so wanted to fit in, but I felt that I wasn't. Externally, it looked like I was doing fine. It was all internally. I had all this misery. I did well at school. I did well in sports, but you know, growing up with parents who were a bit offline and not really present with me, I created this internal dialogue that said I am unlovable, and I kind of reflected that into the world. And so I survived high school. I got through it, but I remember there were two events in that around that age that really affected me. One was my dog Woofie that I really loved died. That was really my first experience of death. I remember being a child and like driving on the road and there'd be an accident and my father would forcibly cover my eyes and not let me see. I remember a grandfather dying when I was about 8 and they're not allowing me to go to the funeral and a few of my parents' aunts. I was very distant from all of that. And I believe that I think I was a sensitive child and my parents just didn't want to deal with my emotions. So they tried to keep that from occurring. But then when my dog died, I just had this like deep, deep gut punch. Like this, it was a feeling I'd never encountered before. I could hardly breathe. I sequestered into a room for maybe a couple days, just crying and crying. And it was like, how could this be? Something I love is here. And then it's not. Like, where did it go? Why is that happening? And like adults would give explanations, but none of them were satisfying. Like, you know, he's in doggy heaven now. It seemed to satisfy my brother, my parents, but it wasn't any comfort to me. It created something that I just could not resolve. So again, I felt alone in my feelings. In 11th grade, I was kind of forced to decide what I'm supposed to do with my life, which I hadn't really thought of until then. I had no role model to guide me, and you know, these are the questions you should be asking. What will make you happy? What can you do that will be a benefit to the world? These just weren't questions I knew to ask. So I found a magazine in the library, the school library, and it said the 20 most well-paid career paths or something like that. And I knew I was good in math and science, so I found one of them on the list. It was engineering. It seemed like something I could do, so that was my choice, which really affected like a huge part of my life. So I kind of wish I had the skills to ask the right questions at that point in my life. But I went into college, and I remember it was in upper Michigan. I got as far away from my parents as I could, but at the same time, not out of the state, because that was a little too scary. Like I had this, you know, stay away, but yet I need the comfort of familiarity. In upper Michigan, the main social event was drinking games. And I remember there was a point, maybe sophomore year, I just found myself walking out into the woods, finding a tree, and just sobbing. And I didn't know why, I was just sobbing. It was very therapeutic to allow myself to do that, because I didn't realize this at the time until writing this, that like I did shifts in my life. Drinking alcohol, I became disenchanted with it. I had a long genetic history of alcoholism, and I somehow was able to escape that. When I was in graduate school, I joined this intramural hockey team with a wonderful group of guys. The whole season, it was just a pleasure. They were just very sweet. And I didn't know anything about their religion or anything, but at the end of the day, of the last game, they sat down with me and asked me to join their born-again Christian group. And I was a bit taken back. I was reactionary the way my parents were reactionary, and I kind of challenged them, asking them questions like, so you're saying somebody born in another culture who never heard of Jesus, they're going to hell? You really believe that? But they were they weren't like fighting back at me. And so I was left with myself. When I walked away, I was like, actually, I don't really know what the hell's going on. Like, what is really true? What is truth? What is, like everybody has an opinion, a view, like God is this, no, God is that, no, God is the way I see it, or there is no God. And whatever view I took, I recognize it's just going to be a view like anyone else's. It's not really what is true. And so that really started precipitating my, you know, questioning. And I was really naive. I hadn't encountered any teachers or anything. I thought, is there anyone in the world that knows what's going on? And I was a bit cynic, and I said, I doubt it. But I determined I'm going to figure this out when I graduate. So I was really lucky. I got a really wonderful job in San Diego, California, launching satellites. It was like a dream job. And it was a dream job for a little while until I started learning about the mystery of how it all works. And the weather was perfect, but that was depressing after a while. There was a point, though, where I was not getting the excitement out of my job that I came into it with. Plus, being in California, like the Beach Boys and everybody was saying that this is where happiness is. So I thought that would be the case, but it wasn't turning out that way for me. And I found myself like being obsessed with like wanting a promotion, wanting a raise, wanting more appreciation. And really, like the core of it was wanting to be loved, wanting to feel connected, and I wasn't getting that from sitting in front of a computer all day. So it was around this time that a friend of mine gave me a Eastern religious text by Krishnamurti called Freedom from the Known. I'd never encountered anything other than Christianity before, and I read that, and I was like, oh my God, there are people who know something about this life. And I got so excited, and I was devouring everything I could read. And I was starting to hone in on Buddhism because it seemed to offer a path, a method. I wasn't interested in Zen for a while because I liked Theravada because it felt I could feel like I understand, and that felt comforting to me if I understand what they're saying. So there was, and I was just reading, and I would read about, you know, about meditation. I'd be like, yeah, I understand. And it was all intellect. It was like I was getting my intellect satisfied, but not my heart. And then there was a point where I had to go to the emergency room because I had a ear infection, and the doctor gave me some penicillin. It cleared right up. It was great. Maybe a week or two later, it came back, but it spread to my eye. And I went back, took penicillin again. It was great. And then the third time I came in, and the doctor said, wait a minute, I'm going to give you this experimental pill. And I'm like, what does that do? What's it for? And he's like, this is supposed to help with stress. And then like something clicked in my mind from what I was reading. Like, if I'm stressed, my mind is creating that. I'm responsible for my stress, not this pill. So I rejected the pill. I took the penicillin. And I sat for the very first time, and it was so powerful. I must have sat for maybe 10 minutes, but there was such a clear, like painful thoughts that I kind of saw through and like released, and I felt this calm I'd never experienced before. It was like the magic of beginner's mind. And I never had the ear infection again. And I don't think I ever not sat again. I was totally hooked. But my sitting was turbulent. I didn't know what sitting still was. I would squirm, and sometimes I would sit for 5 minutes and then find myself up and doing what my thought said to do without realizing I was doing that. And sometimes I'd sit for 20 minutes, but I made sure I always sat at least for 5 minutes. But then there was a point like 5 years in, and I was a closet Buddhist. I grew up where if you didn't believe Jesus Christ was your savior, then you were following the devil, and I was afraid somebody would know I'm following the devil. And I had a roommate, and for three years he never knew I sat. But then my job moved to Denver, and I started realizing I do need help, and I sought out. I went to this Thai temple, and there was this old Thai man who used to be a monk for 20 years, and I would just be mesmerized in this big shrine room with this big Buddha and the beautiful incense and him teaching, stories of the Buddha, and I was just so enchanted, and I committed to making this my teacher. But then I did a Vipassana retreat, and there was just a few of us because he was a small sangha, and he wouldn't sit with us. He would be away, but he would come in for interviews. And I remember I was deep in this, and I had a pretty clear mind, and I could see he was like distracted. He wasn't paying attention, and I just became so disenchanted. I'm like, I was angry for him for a long time, and I kind of stopped going to him, but. I was kind of really projecting perfection in him and what he should be for me, but I wasn't able to. It really popped my idealism bubble of thinking if you're a monk, if you're Asian, if you wrote a book on meditation, you have to be enlightened. That's just all there is to it. And this was kind of the magical phase of my life where I would go into a store and a book would pop up, and it would be exactly what I needed. Like it would just call to me, or I'd turn on PBS and there'd be these amazing shows I never experienced, like Joseph Campbell or other things. And like my worldview was just like, it was just such a beautiful time. And then part of this magic is I got my first computer. This was like in the mid 90s, and was able through my work to hook up to the internet. And the first thing I did as I went into what's called Internet Relay Chat, IRC, and into a Buddhism group. And there was this person there who was an American Thai monk who I just had such a karmic connection with him. He would say things, and it was the perfect thing. He was my teacher. I knew that. We would do, like, this was way before Zoom, so there's no video, but we had a small online sangha, and we would sit together, and my sitting would feel more powerful than it ever had just from knowing that this person's present with me. And And it was a magical time. I invited him to the Thai temple. He was a monk. And I would stay up late at night, every night, and he'd give me personal one-on-one Dharma talks. And I would just be mesmerized, not caring that I had to go to work the next morning. And can't really explain it, but there was an experience where I just knew that I have to devote myself to this life. There's nothing more worthy than to commit myself to this practice. And we moved to Illinois and rented a place and where someone else was living, and we had a small little Sangha practice for about a year. But then he disrobed and kind of started forming a family. His life was going in a different direction, and I just knew I need help. I need a Sangha. I need a community. So I found myself here. He recommended I come to Dido Lori, who he felt was really clear. And I did my first residency. It was a month of residency in August of 98. It's such a rich month that I can almost remember almost every detail, it seems like. It was the quickest month and the longest month at the same time. And I loved being with Sangha. I'd never been with community. I just had one brother and wished I had a big family. But it was also the most challenging thing in the world. I would see my mind judging, be critical. My self-criticism is just all exposed. It's like, oh my God, this is too much. I can't handle this. I want to go back into the womb. So I did 4 months, and then I went back to my parents, because I went there thinking I was going to ordain and this was going to be my life. I didn't realize how challenging facing, being still and facing one's karma actually is. So I wasn't quite ready, but then I spent the winter with my parents, and by the end of that, I was ready. So I came back, and I stayed there for a couple years. I was on the track to ordain. I wanted this to be my life, but again, there's these karmic pulls that's like, I'm scared of this. I don't want to. I want to find an escape hatch. I want to find a way around my suffering and not face it. And I did what I think is kind of a common thing. I started seeking relationship, thinking the ideal partner will give me just permanent pleasure and everything will be wonderful and I don't have to face myself, was basically really what I was doing. But at the end of my 2 years, we left and moved to New Mexico. We eventually got married. And I had really no idea of the commitment I was making being with this person, but I realized I need to keep turning. It was a difficult relationship. It was like a karmic relationship. It's like she brought up all of my mother issues. I brought up all of her father issues, and we were just faced with like, wait a minute, this isn't fair. I thought this was going to be better than what it was. It's actually harder. But we had good times and bad times, and I don't regret any of it. She's a very beautiful person. But in all these challenges, this difficulties that were coming, I tended to like shut down and close off and like go to my man cave. And after about 7 years of this, she decided she had enough, and she asked for a divorce. And I was living in Brooklyn here. We walked to the place to sign the papers, and just a big wave of appreciation for her and gratitude just come, and all of my resistance towards her like dissolved, and she felt that, and we were like signing the divorce papers while we were holding hands and crying, and we became like closer than we ever had once we divorced. But I was free of that commitment of marriage, and I started again contemplating monasticism. And I was practicing here, coming every morning and evening, and I was working with Shugen Roshi on it. And then not too long after, my partner came to me and told me that she had cancer. So I turned to her, and she was from Germany, so I tried to fill her bucket list of things to do. We moved to Italy, rented a villa, But she had committed to not doing chemotherapy. That was her deep view, was that she can heal this without through alternative means, and she wanted me to support her in that. But I and her mother were her caregiver, and 5 years later she did die. And then that grief that I felt for Wolfie was like amplified by like 100. It was like a year of nonstop grief just flowing. It eventually slowly started subsiding. 2 years ago, the grief would just be now and then, and by 5 years, it kind of dissipated. But it really brought up questions like, what is this grief? What am I grieving? Does it have to do with me and my death? Is there a relationship between this painful grief and like clinging to the self, which is always changing? What is death anyway? I don't know. So then at that point, I felt like there was no place else for me to go. No more escape hatches. I went back to the monastery. I started the process of ordaining, which I did a couple years ago. I'm left with kind of the understanding that, sitting completely still, facing karma, allowing it all in is really challenging, but it's so worth it. There's nothing more worth it than doing that. What else? My sort of mini little wisdom is that there's this dynamic tension in practice. On one hand, just relax. The path unfolds as it does. You can't predict it. You can't control it. Just relax into the practice. The other side of it is make sure you are practicing. Have some inquiry. Am I on the path? Am I practicing my edge? Am I engaging in what's arising? You could call that doubt and faith. Those two are both needed. And if you have those two, it doesn't matter how your life unfolds. You don't have to be a monk to do this. It's just the way mine went. But it will go in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.